Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, January 22nd, 2013. President Obama installed for his second term in inaugural festivities yesterday. And I've been taking care of business every day. Taking care of business every way. I've been taking care of business. It's all mine. Taking care of business and working overtime. When you boil it down, the president was sworn in a private ceremony at the White House by the Chief Justice on Sunday in concordance with the Constitution. January 20th is the official day at noon when a president is sworn into office. And so the festivities, which took place on Monday and drew somewhere upwards of 700,000 people to downtown Washington, D.C., were, in my view, really unnecessary. And given the pain and suffering that continues in this country, to spend $50 million on an inauguration and to accept corporate contributions, including $250,000 from ExxonMobil, is really just gross. And certainly every president is entitled to an inauguration. I don't want to single out Obama as somehow being offensive. But when you boil it down, the purpose of this $50 million inaugural was to give face time to the funders who paid for his billion-dollar campaign. And some of those were average Americans who gave $5 or $25 to that endless string of emails we received all last year. But a lot of it came from fat cats, from the pirate class in this country, the people who escaped prosecution for financial misdeeds that occurred before Obama became president, and many others who have gotten rich while the rest of us have struggled mightily over the last 4 years. And while the president gave a good speech, he is a good speech maker. And there were some interesting new themes in there. He added Stonewall and messages of equality for gays and lesbians in this country. So he's showing some courage in that respect, and I appreciate it. But he didn't make the same mistake that he did 4 years ago and promised to close Guantanamo. And frankly, his soaring rhetoric was hard for me to get excited about because I get stuck on the very first part of it, where he put his hand over two Bibles, including one that belonged to Martin Luther King, who he can never bring himself to actually name. There it was, the national holiday, in honor of Dr. King. And the president couldn't mention him by name, as if it would make him into some sort of an angry black man. And as he put his hand on those Bibles and promised to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, I'm sorry, I was lounging in bed. And it really bothers me to hear him swear an oath to the Constitution that he has nullified and rolled back in many significant ways. Some of it simply extending the work of his predecessor. But it's Obama's signature now on the FISA law extension for 5 years without amendments that sharply erodes our Fourth Amendment rights. And as we'll get to in a moment, it is Obama's signature, his ownership of the drone program and the targeted killing of individuals, some of whom we're not even sure who they are. And these expansions of presidential power, the bypassing of important standards of due process that were part of our system for centuries, these are things I can't just laugh off or overcome. You know, policy differences like on the Health Care Act, I can get over that. But I have a hard time getting over the limitation of our constitutional rights under a president who taught constitutional law, and who campaigned with clear messages to change the erosion of our Bill of Rights that had occurred under Bush. Now, the president also talked about climate change. And while he made a mention in his acceptance speech at the convention in Charlotte, and talked about it a couple of times on the campaign trail, actions speak louder than words. And if we're going to make any effort in reducing greenhouse gases, reducing our reliance on carbon-based fuels, dealing with the methane releases that occur with hydraulic fracturing, that's fracking for oil and natural gas, well, it comes down to how tough is the new director of the Environmental Protection Agency going to be? Will it be a toady who backs down when industry gets its back up? We told you just last week about the case in Texas, where the EPA initially declared an emergency when well water was clearly tainted by nearby fracking. And when the guilty party got through to its connections at the EPA, suddenly it wasn't an emergency anymore. And we saw Lisa Jackson have to backtrack on important rules that her agency had worked on for several years. Because during the campaign cycle, Barack Obama didn't want to risk losing votes in coal states. And so I have these mixed feelings. Because certainly I'm glad it wasn't Mitt Romney taking that oath of office. But that lesser of two evils only lasts so long, only goes so far. And on the fundamental issues of our constitutional rights, I consider Barack Obama to be a failure. And intentional. This is not negligence. He's not a victim of circumstances or Republican extremism. These are policies that he has chosen. Now, at a conference, a little retreat, that Republican leaders of the House held in Williamsburg, Virginia last week, Obama scored a victory. The Republicans blinked in their plans to tie an increase in the debt ceiling to extortion. Extortion based on phony budget cuts. And as you hear me say often here, if we're going to do anything about the deficit, you have to start with our annual budget, which is running a $1 trillion deficit. And the biggest place to whack away is defense, intelligence, and so-called homeland security. And as much as the Republicans piss and moan, they're not willing to make cuts in those areas at all. And so, you know, it's a momentary victory for the president. They've agreed to delay it by 90 days and give a short-term extension of the debt ceiling. But I would score one for the Obama team. In our in-depth interview released today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com, we talk with Iyad Bernat, who is a Palestinian who lives in the West Bank, and whose town has lost 60% of its land to Israeli expansionism. His brother, Imad Bernat, is the filmmaker of a documentary, and just a few days after we recorded this video interview for local cable here in Marin County, California, it was announced that the film has received an Oscar nomination for Best Documentary. I recommend the film. You can get it online at Hulu.com, and you might be able to find it elsewhere. But in this excerpt from our in-depth interview with Iyad Bernat, you hear him talk about how the Palestinians use peaceful, nonviolent tactics to protest the muscular expansion of Israeli settlements right in their backyards where they used to pick olives, and how the Israelis will insert paid provocateurs who pose as Palestinians And they're the ones who start the violence. They throw rocks at soldiers, and then the soldiers crack down on the Palestinians who didn't throw rocks with real live bullets, rubber bullets, tear gas. And they round up Palestinians and subject them to what's called administrative detention, locking them up for an unknown period of time without trial or charge.
Has anyone ever from your village, and let me just put a window on it, in the last 10 years, launched a rocket from the Palestinian land into Israel?
From our village in our life, not in 10 years, nobody do that. The Palestinian there is peaceful people, and all everywhere we have the Palestinian people that's suffering in Gaza, in West Bank, in Belayin. Every day they're suffering. But the Israelis army, every time try to push them, sometimes to use the violent, like in Gaza, or in other places, or in our non-violent demonstration, sometimes. They try to push the people to use the violent. For example, in our demonstration, they were sending special forces from the army, undercover, wore like our clothes, join us in our demonstration, and started to throw to the stones to the soldiers.
Provocateurs.
So, yeah, it's they want to change in front of the media and the famous people who comes to Belayin and in big demonstration, they want to change the demonstration to violent in front of the media, to have a reason to attack this demonstration. And we have sometimes in our demonstrations a member from Israeli Knesset, a member from European Parliament, and a lot of media, international media. So when they saw that, they didn't want to show a Palestinian as a nonviolent or peaceful. They want to change this by using these special forces in our demonstration. But because we have our strategy in Belayin that we didn't use the violent, every time we catch them and we know them. Because all our people know that we didn't throw stones. Who's these people that comes to throw stones in our actions and our demonstrations? So every time we catch him. And when we was catching him, they take the guns and start to shoot.
You can hear the full interview with Iyad Bernat. As I mentioned, it's available right now for subscribers at peterbcollins.com. If you're not a subscriber, buy a 24-hour pass for $1, a monthly pass for $5, annual just $50. I appreciate your support, and I need your financial help to maintain this independent voice in the media. The latest issue of the New Yorker magazine arrived the other day with a powerful, lengthy essay by its editor, David Remnick. And it is about the elections that are occurring in Israel today. Now, it's quite likely the Netanyahu government will get an extension of its lease. The most interesting thing to watch for, though, is one of the secondary parties, which is called Habayit HaYehudi. And forgive me, my my language skills are limited. It translates to the Jewish Home Party, and its candidate is Naftali Bennett. And this is a guy to watch, because if you think Benjamin Netanyahu is a hardline conservative, this guy makes Netanyahu look like an expansive liberal and a guy who's working for peace. Naftali Bennett has flatly said that there is no occupation. The land is ours, he says, and he bases that on biblical declarations that are, decades, centuries old. He said, "I will do everything in my power forever to fight against a Palestinian state being founded in the land of Israel. I don't think there is a clear-cut solution for the Israeli-Arab conflict in this generation." And Remnick quotes Zippy Livni, the former foreign minister, who is hardly soft on the Palestinian question, and she laments that there is no hope for peace. "Most people," she said, "think that the Palestinians refuse every offer. The whole world is against us anyway. They're all anti-Semitic and so on. and the ideological settlers think that every day that passes without negotiations is a victory. And we'll report to you in the next day or so the results of the Israeli election. But the idea that peace talks can be restarted with just a little nudge from the Obama administration? Not very likely. And I find that quite tragic. Well, I feel like I need to set up a new segment of our daily news and comment called Bill of Rights Watch, because I have four stories here that fit into the issues that I raised about the president's renewal of his oath of office to defend, protect, and preserve the Constitution. One of the things that's been going on at the White House is the development of what is called a playbook, a counterterrorism playbook. It's a manual that sets the rules of engagement, for targeted killing operations using drone strikes and other methods. Now, this is the work of John Brennan, whom the president has nominated to run the CIA. Now, first of all, the idea that we somehow can use a playbook to substitute for due process of law is deeply offensive to me. And just having a rule book doesn't mean that the rules are followed, and it doesn't mean that they meet the basic standards of international human rights. That said, it's even more offensive to me that John Brennan, who is the author of this effort to set some sort of standards for our targeted killing program, will move over to the CIA. His confirmation, as I've pointed out before, will be viewed as as consent of the United States Senate for the drone and killing programs. And the idea that he's a good guy because he's made a rule book is just preposterous. Among the subjects covered in the playbook, the process for adding names to kill lists, the legal principles that govern when U.S. citizens can be targeted overseas, and the sequence of approvals required when the CIA or U.S. military conducts drone strikes outside of war zones. Now, the Washington Post article I'm referring to right now highlights that the CIA, and remember, Brennan came from the CIA, he's at the White House, he wrote this rule book that has exceptions for the CIA, and in particular, the use of drones in Pakistan. So this is hardly a playbook or a rule book or a manual. It's some very loose guidelines. And one CIA officer or a former U.S. official, who is unnamed but quoted in this article, said, you know, there's a sense that you put the pedal to the metal now, especially given the impending withdrawal from Afghanistan. What he's saying is that we use drones and other aerial assets to just bomb the country relentlessly. Well, that's what we did in Vietnam. The last 2 years before we left in shame were the heaviest years of bombing in Vietnam. And the other piece here is the difference between targeted killing and signature strikes. A signature strike means we have some evidence like aerial surveillance that maybe weapons had been moved into a specific location. And that is seen as sufficient evidence to launch a Hellfire missile from a drone at that target. But we have no idea who's there, whether they're storing them in an area where women and children are likely to be. And worse, we don't seem to care. And the blowback that continues to build from this ruthless action is something we will pay for many years to come. Next item here in our Bill of Rights defense section. 3 years ago, U.S. officials launched a review of significant classified rulings by the FISA court. That's the court where it's real easy to get a warrant to wiretap me. After 3 years, nothing has been released. They claim it's simply not possible to remove target information and operational information so that we can see the legal reasoning, such as it is, used to support the rulings of this secret court. And to his credit, Jeff Merkley, in his first term as senator from Oregon, asked that the rulings be revealed to the American public during the FISA renewal discussions. They were modest debates during the last week of the Senate session in 2012. They are unable to share with us even a sketchy outline of how they arrive at their decisions and what the basis in law is. Merkley's colleague from Oregon, Ron Wyden, also tried very hard, first putting a hold and then casting the only no vote in the Senate Intelligence Committee on a bill that has expanded several anti-leak provisions. New limits on background briefings by intelligence officials, a constitutionally questionable prohibition on a broad range of former government employees providing paid analysis or commentary on intelligence matters, the ability to strip intelligence officers of their pensions if they disclose classified information, even if the disclosure poses no harm to national security. Yep, sailed right through that committee, with only Ron Wyden casting a no vote. And this further cements the reality that official leaks in Washington are okay. Calculated leaks, ones that come from these unnamed government sources. But when a whistleblower or a Bradley Manning fights against wrongdoing and tries to expose the truth, we slam the door on them. And over the weekend, we learned that the Transportation Security Administration is removing the Chertoff Memorial X-ray scanning machines from airports. This is a minor victory for those of us who resist giving up our constitutional rights just to enter an airport and get on a plane. But the failure of the company that makes these machines to provide software that would cover my junk has caused them to lose the contract. And TSA is removing these machines that conducted a virtual strip search. Now, this is a minor victory because, of course, the security theater continues at the airports with no end in sight. Over at Guantanamo, where our friend Jason Leopold, the reporter from truthout.org, is headed later this week, the military judge presiding over the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed trial said that he rejected a defense motion that requested that the judge stipulate that he would be following the Constitution during the kangaroo court proceedings. And the judge said that he would not do that. And he said that constitutional rights seem to be optional. As we try to promote the so-called rule of law in the pre-cooked conviction of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the other four individuals charged with masterminding 9/11. The judge will not even stipulate that it will be a constitutional process. Last week, we told you about the case of a Florida imam and his sons. The family name is Khan, K-H-A-N. It's a complicated case, but fundamentally, the U.S. attorney indicted them for sending money to a school in Pakistan that this family started. And a little bit of good news, the federal judge in this Florida courtroom has dismissed terrorism support and conspiracy charges against the younger of two Muslim clerics. Judge Robert Scola Jr. ruled that no rational trier of fact could convict Izhar Khan, age 26, who's an imam at a mosque in suburban Fort Lauderdale. The case against his 77-year-old father continues. And finally today, the ugly hostage scene at the natural gas facility in Algeria had a very bloody ending. 38 workers and 29 militants, those who assaulted the facility, were killed. And while this is, in the American media, made out to be a kind of isolated incident, it's clearly connected to the French military actions in Mali, which the U.S. is supporting. We're providing transport and surveillance for the French in this area. And a rare voice of reason, Paul Pillar, former CIA analyst who now teaches at Georgetown, quoted in the New York Times, concerned about U.S. getting entangled in Algeria. He said, if we do that, it puts a transnational framework on top of what is fundamentally a set of local concerns, and we risk making ourselves more of an enemy than we would otherwise be. And I recommend to you my friend and colleague Pepe Escobar at Asia Times, online atimes.com. He wrote a lengthy piece about Mali and Algeria, connecting it to our toppling of the Gaddafi government in Libya. Pepe offers us that non-aligned multinationalist or internationalist view. And I'll put up a link to the story in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. This is the free daily news and comment podcast, and you are free to circulate it to your friends and invite them to visit me at peterbcollins.com. Thank you very much.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.